myself again, I'm Jan Fall, and I'm a parent educator. I used to work in the community college system in Washington State, and then also done a variety of writing and speaking things in my professional life, and now I only do freelance writing and speaking. It's a luxury I can enjoy, thankfully, at this time of my life. So anyway, I've always, for a long time, wanted to, in my professional life, talk to parents about instilling virtues, values, and morals. But I always felt kind of, because I worked in the public school, you know, community colleges are public institutions, and a lot of public schools would hire me to come in and talk to parents, and I never felt it was really my, you know, part of what I should be doing. And then, during the first Bush and Clinton campaign, they started arguing about family values. We're the party of family values, the Republicans say, and then we're the party of family values, the Democrats would say. And then I was just like, wait a minute, it's not about political parties, it's about parents. Parents are the people who instill virtues, values, and morals in their children. And that's when I started speaking on these topics. And there was a period, not right now, but there was a period maybe, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, that this was the most frequent request that I would get from schools to come in and talk on. Now it's entitlement. Some of you were here yesterday for that. But anyway, so that's the history behind it. So what I'm just going to get into my information, and we'll keep it light, and I want to hear from you as well as you will be hearing from me. So, quite often in my parenting career, I'm the bearer of bad news, and I'm going to give you some bad news right now. All of your children will not go to Harvard, and all of your children will probably not be Olympic athletes. However, I truly believe, deep in my heart, that all of your children can be virtuous individuals with good values and good character and know what's right from wrong. And when I talk about virtues, values, and morals, I want to be really clear that I'm not talking about virtues, values, and morals that are important to Jan Fall. I want you to identify the virtues, values, and morals that are important to you and your family, and then more intentionally figure out how to go about instilling those in your children. There's some general ways that we can go about it, but the, you know, what's most important to you will be different what what's most important to me, and what's most important to you will be different than what's important to you. So, for the sake of providing definitions for this particular topic, values, what you communicate to your children your values by how you spend your time, how you focus your attention, and how you spend your money. So think about that. We're going to get into that later. Virtues are the qualities that you hope that your children will display as they're growing up. Could be anything from honesty to integrity to compassion for other people. The morals are doing what's right by your definition when no one else is watching. Doing what's right even when everyone else is doing what's wrong. And doing what's right even if the only person you hurt is yourself. And so obviously it takes a while to instill those virtues, values, and morals in your children. So let's project ahead. We're going to take values first, then virtues, then morals. So let's project. Yes.
Did you say the virtue part again?
It's the qualities you want to instill in your child. What kind of people you want them to be? Honest. We'll go through. There's a list a mile long, but anyway, honesty, integrity, those kinds of things. Okay, so let's project ahead to the time when your kids might be 25. And think about it. How do you hope that they are spending their time? How do you hope they are focusing their energy or their attention? How do you hope they're spending their money? What are some of the values that you hope that they will hold? hold dear?
Loyalty.
Loyalty. Okay. Now, loyalty, and this is just the sake of definition. Loyalty to me in this presentation is more a virtue than a value. Okay. A value is how you spend your time, how you focus your energy, and how you spend your money. So we're going to, yes, sir, right here.
Community service.
Okay, so of course, we all hope, I would assume, that we hope our children will do some kind of community service, whether it's working at a soup kitchen, or working at a food bank, or, you know, I don't know what else. You could, there's probably many, many things that you could do. Okay, so we all hope our children do community service. Okay, what else? Yes?
If they have a job, I would like them to be doing their best.
Okay, so
working hard, you know.
Maybe. Sure, we all want children. I mean, we're the worker bees of the world, right? And we hope that our children put their best effort forward. Absolutely. Who can argue with that? Okay? Yes?
And that career-wise, they choose something where they can make a difference and not just make a living?
Okay, so that, absolutely, that we hope that they can make a difference, and rather than just something that's kind of mundane or pedestrian, we hope that they're actually making the world a better place. Yeah, and that could be a very broad kind of thing, but, all right.
Stewardship of their money and their time, which would include philanthropic, but in my case it would include supporting your church if you belong to a church.
Financially, tithing money, giving, yeah, absolutely, okay?
I'd say within that, having a community of faith.
Sure, having a community of faith. I think we at Holding can all agree on that. David, you had one.
Oh, that they be readers, or whether print, online, but that they be absorbing.
Sure.
New ideas.
Yeah, of course that's what we want for our kids. Anything else? I mean, there's many, many, but anything else that particularly comes to mind? No.
That they deal with conflicts in their life directly and respectfully.
Okay, so they figure out how to do that, manage
not
conflict.
Not aggressive.
Yeah.
Yes.
If you've got somebody who can do that, I need help today. I'm having a conflict with a woman who was the researcher for my books. So that's another story, but it's on my mind. So if anybody can, lend me some support and ideas, I'm happy to get it. Anyway, so there's many. I mean, you mentioned reading, sports. I mean, most of us would hope our children, if they're not actually involved in organized sports, that they might hike or bike or do something to keep their body healthy. We mentioned academics, or did we? Education, learning, that it's not just, we hope they're all good students, but we also hope that they continue learning throughout life. Maybe music is part of your life, and you hope your children will absorb that value that your family values. Let's see, we mentioned work, religion, family. I mean, don't you hope that your kids will come and visit you when they're 25 or older, that family will still be important, and positive friendship. So, I mean, there's many, many more, but those are pretty much the basics that most people mention. So how do you do it? How do you go about instilling these values in your children? Okay, you have to. That's the first and most important, is that you have to be a good role model. You have to do it. I mean, if you want your children to help feed hungry people, you need to go to the soup kitchen and you need to take them along from a young age on and get them involved. So, but I want to be really clear that modeling is not enough. Now, when my parents were raising us, it probably was enough because we had very few influences in our lives. We had home, church, and school, and that was it. My sisters and I would come home after school because my mom worked, and we'd watch the Mickey Mouse Club, and on Saturday, and then American Bandstand, and on Saturday night we would all dance to Lawrence Welk. That was my mom and dad and me and my sisters. That was pretty much our life. And playing outside. I mean, we didn't have many influences. So my parents had an easy time of it, right? But today, children have many, many more influences pulling them away. And the media is one, peers, of course, is another, which we had too, but the peers were, and we lived in a very homogeneous community, and everybody pretty much did the same thing. And so your children are exposed to many, many other influences. influences that are pulling them away from the values that you hold dear. So we have to work harder, okay? So what else do you need to do in order to instill those values in your children?
Well, just a slight expansion. When I think of role models, I don't just think of my husband and me. Mm-hmm. I think of our network of close friends.
Okay.
So that when we, and the ones we do activities with, the people, mm-hmm. the other adults they're close to, that they all kind of reflect our values. So it's
right.
not just us, but everywhere they turn in activities,
absolutely.
They see those same kinds of things.
And hopefully that's not just something you do that's haphazard, but that you're intentional and thoughtful about that because you want, I mean, it could be, but you know, you think, I want my children to go in a certain direction, and here's a way that can help out. And by having adult peers and adult friends and peers and their children who are your children's peers doing the same thing certainly underlines that.
Mm-hmm. Because there's so many other things like music and movies and stuff, and you can't be around all the time just talking about it. And for example, in a car when they want to listen to the hip hop station.
Mm-hmm.
And Wendy does a good job of saying we can listen to it until it's offensive to me, and then
okay.
we're changing it.
Okay, so...
So knowing that they're going to do, see, hear things all the time, but as long as you're having conversation about it,
right.
like, you know what, you're going to see this kind of stuff, and that's either this isn't cool, or this isn't respectful, or
right.
spiritually speaking, this is not helpful for us.
Yeah, and so you're getting your, you know, it's what I said the other day when we talked about teens, at least you're getting your one-third in. There's the peers and the media, and so by doing that, you're getting your one-third in, and that's really important. Yeah.
Right, and then hopefully it shows up again when they're not at home or not around
yeah.
us, and that comes up, and they're like, Mom doesn't like this.
Right, and that's what we call a conscience, and we hope that all children develop a conscience, okay? Yeah.
Yeah, I was kind of the same line, the idea of setting some boundaries and limits. You allow them
mm-hmm.
so far, and then as a parent, you pull back and say, no, that's
right.
Kind of
and so there's some discipline and some rules. And I think that we don't want to be afraid of doing that. That's what we parents are here to do. And they surround our values. And just like somebody said earlier, going to church on Sunday morning, I mean, that's, you know, we just, in my family growing up, that's just what we did. I mean, and we would, you know, we would lie. We would say things like, oh, you know, we just had this big... term paper due on Monday, and my dad said, nevertheless, we go to church on Sunday morning, and that's, you know, that's what we did, and so it really instilled that value in us. We tried all kinds of things to get out of it, but the other thing, though, that was important about that, and that's important about instilling values, once we got to church, then not only was it fun, because our friends were there, and we liked the adults who were there, too, but I remember so much my dad at church, because he would surround us with love and nurture when we were there. He would, you know, step back with three girls in the family, I'm the youngest, step back and seat us very respectfully in the pews. He would help us with our coats. He would put his arm around our shoulder as we sat in the pews. And so it was a comforting place. I mean, it wasn't like, and I was thinking about now be quiet in church and you know, that kind of thing. So I caught myself one time taking my kids to church because, you know, there I am kind of, shh, would you be quiet? I'm kicking them. Would you just shh? And I think, how are they going to like this place? I'm just being so kind of cruel to them at church. And so we want that feeling, no matter what it is. If it's reading, we don't say to a child, no, sit here and read a book. You know, no, we bring them onto our lap. We read the book with them. We emote. And emotion is another thing that bonds children to a value, that if you read a book and laugh and cry and talk about it together, discuss it, that's another thing that binds them to that activity. And so there's a few other things. Food is another one. That you think about, again, using the example of church, that if there's a coffee hour where you typically have a little something good afterwards, that's another thing that can bind children to that value. And also, with the value, you don't want to compartmentalize it. So you think about reading, that it's not that, certainly you want to have a discipline about that, that yes, we read a book every night before bed, but that books are a part of our entire life, that if we're going on a trip, we read a book about travel. If we're cooking something, we open a cookbook. If we want to learn about whatever it is that we want to learn about, bugs or flowers or whatever happens to be, we go to a book for it. Of course, now it's the internet and all of that, and who knows what libraries will be in the future. And now we have, you know, how do you warm up to a Kindle? I don't know. But anyway, we'll probably all be doing that, and certainly our children will. But the point is that we don't, it's just not this one little time during the day before bed that we read a story, but books are all a part of our life. And same with prayer. I mean, we don't just go to church on Sunday morning and pray, but we pray before dinner, we pray before bed, we can pray spontaneously through the day as situations arise, so it's part of our everyday existence. Okay, let's see, make it a high priority. And that's something you really have to think about, because there are so many influences pulling us away. And, you know, I think so often if you would ask a child, you know, let me tell you this story. So this is where it became very clear to me that, you know, I might be in trouble with my youngest son. He had a class or an assignment from school. And the assignment was, what does your family value most? Okay, fifth grade, all right? So he's at the kitchen table doing his homework, and he's just kind of walking around the kitchen table. I said, what is my family value most? And, you know, I wanted to kind of say, you know, academics or church or family, but I didn't. I just zipped my lip and I let him, you know, stew about this. And so then he said, Mom, I've got it. I know what it is that our family values most. I said, what is it, Alan? He says, appliances. Well, you know, when you think about it, when the refrigerator goes out, it's a pretty big deal. Or if you can't get the garage door open, you know, and this is a kid who really likes mechanical things. And so, you know, so you just kind of take a deep breath, right? And so, anyway, so then he actually, I mean, I'm embarrassed to tell you the story, but I mean, these are kids because, you know, they're pretty concrete, right, even at fifth grade. And so then he actually prioritized them, and he said that the refrigerator was the most important appliance, and then the microwave oven, and then the television set. But then I do have to say that when he went off to high school, he had to write a story, or he had to write something about what do I like most about my family? And what he wrote was that his family ate together most nights. And so it's like I redeemed myself a little bit by ninth grade. But anyway, so you just have to kind of watch it, because you can get it caught up in work and in household maintenance and getting food on the table, and you begin to wonder, you know, how you are spending your time, how you are spending your money, and how you are focusing your attention, even though you have really good intentions that other things might you instill in your children as values, but really something far different is coming across to your children. So it's kind of scary to take a closer look. A few other things to keep in mind about instilling values: that it's okay to do a little lecturing to children. This is why it's important to me. Now, when children, I think it's also important to understand the developmental process, that when kids are little, you want to get them in the habits of your values, whether it's eating dinner together or going to church or reading stories or whatever. When they're between 6 and 12, then we explain to children, we engage their intellect, why these values are important to us, okay? And then we want to understand that by the time kids get to the teen years, they will be questioning, if not rebelling, someone against your values. Please don't take it personally. Don't panic. Keep them in place as much as possible. As I said the other night when I talked about teens, that when kids are in their mid-20s, between 85 and 90% of kids come back to take on the values of their parents. They're tweaked, of course, a bit for that generation, but they do take them on, because that's how powerful and important you are to your kids. And so I don't want you to panic or get into power struggles over it, because it's not worth losing the relationship with your teenager, because it's normal and natural that they're going to question, if not rebel, from your values. Okay, another thing to think about. I mean, is your cell phone, okay? And how you use your cell phone. Because, I don't know, mine, of course, we don't have it here at Holden, and maybe you are very good, but I mean, my cell phone, I keep it right here most of the time so that I'm available to, who knows, I don't know. There's nobody really that important that is going to be calling me, but I keep it there. And so what do I communicate to, I take care of my granddaughters once a week, to my granddaughters about the importance of cell phone when I keep my cell phone right here, closest to my heart, okay? So they realize quite clearly that grandma's cell phone is important to her. So if prayer is important to me, I better use it as much as I use my cell phone. Boom! We better stop right now in the middle of dinner and pray. Because as if you would respond to your cell phone the same way. Or you're driving. We can't drive in Washington with cell phones anymore. But just, you know, oh, we're driving along. I better answer, you know, oh, I better pray because I would be answering my cell phone. So at least give prayer the same amount of time as your cell phone. Because we want to make sure that we're giving it at least equal to what's really important to us. Okay, so I want you to know that I didn't learn any of these skills from any textbook, any child development book that I've ever read. There are some books out there about instilling values in children. I've never found a really good one. All of these I've learned from parents. And I learned the most from one father who wanted to instill the value of fly fishing in his children. Now, you might say, fly fishing isn't a value. It is a hobby, and I will argue that. And if you're a fly fisherman, you will know what I mean. But this is what the father did. That when the children were two, he would put fly fishing magazines out on the coffee table. And the child, of course, would toddle over and touch one, and he would say, oh, I see that you're interested in fly fishing. Come and sit on daddy's lap. Surround the child with love and nurture. You know, turn the pages, tell a story about what they're seeing. And then when they're three, he takes them out, you know, buys them a little vest, gets them their little fly line, and he will toss the line out into the river and hook the fish. And then he allows the child, right, to reel it in. And then you take pictures. And, of course, you throw the fish back because we're environmental and we do only catch and release. And then you're home, you know, you post the pictures around the house and tells these stories about these, you know, great fly fishing adventures. And then when they're 10, they get to go with dad on their, just the child and the father, to Montana for 10 days fishing. And literally and figuratively, they are hooked. And so, you know, he was very intentional, very supportive. I mean, and if a fish dies, you know, they all emote together. You know, on fishing trips, they have food that, you know, they connect with fishing alone. And so he did a really good job of instilling that value in his children. Okay, so this father has three children, all right? One of the three children is as passionate about fly fishing as he is, okay? The other two have tremendous respect for it, but they don't have the same passion. Why is there one out of the three?
Different kids.
They're absolutely different kids, okay? But what the dad did is he gave it his best shot, right? I mean, to say, no, get in the car and throw out that fly line better and, I mean, do it in that harsh way. All the kids are going to hate it, right? But at least those children, they learned a lot of things about the environment. They learned about etymology. They learned they had a wonderful time with their dad. But you know, only one has the same passion. So it's one, two, and three kind of. So anyway, thinking about that, I think it will keep that picture in your mind of what you have to do and the intentional process that you have to instill values in your children. Any thoughts about all that? Does it all make sense? Okay. All right. So let's move now and talk about virtues. How do you instill virtues in your children? What kind of people do you want them to be? What kind of qualities do you hope that they will have? Pardon?
Honest.
Absolutely, honest. Yes.
What about a healthy sense of what success means.
Okay, right. Whatever that means.
Right.
And you'll have to communicate to that to them.
Right.
Yeah, because we can certainly, in this culture, get confused about what success is. Okay?
Emotionally educated.
Okay. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Well, especially with boys, because all they have is boys. Uh-huh. To make sure that not only are they have EQ, but that they have that emotional side.
Okay. So that's emotional intelligence, emotional quotient,
exactly.
And yeah, there's a lot of good information. John Gottman's the guru of that, and great, yeah. Okay, right here.
Generous.
Pardon?
Generous.
That they're generous, that they're not people who just, you know, of themselves or of their time or of their things, that they just hoard things, whatever. Okay?
Compassion.
Compassion, absolutely. We want children to be able to step into the mind of emotion of other people, think, have empathy for them, and then even help them out. Yeah, you had one. Okay, David, you had one.
That they are driven to accumulate social capital. Mind you, I didn't say financial capital.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Deep friendships, mutual obligations, reciprocity.
Okay. Yeah. And to be a good friend and to pick people who will reciprocate. Okay, I saw some other hands up. Where's that, everybody? That's a really good list. So, again, how do you do that? How do you do it? And we know you have to be a good model for that. And so how else do you go about instilling those virtues in your children? Do you have any ideas about how you do that? Yes, in the back?
I try to really, when I see an action, I try to reinforce that I really appreciated that action that they did.
Okay, so if your child is... your four-year-old takes his cookie and breaks it in half and gives it to his little brother, never mind that it was the smaller half. You say, I see that you're being very generous, kind to your brother. I appreciate that. Okay, so you take the concrete action and attach the abstract label. If you say to a four-year-old, it's really important to be kind and compassionate, that's too abstract, right? So you have to accumulate all these experiences and describe them and attach the abstract label so that they begin to see themselves in that way. Okay? What else? How else do we instill these virtues in children? Yes.
By modeling.
Yeah, by modeling, we have to do that. And also, take it one step further. It's not enough. Remember, I told you that, and so you've got to listen to me, that it's not enough just to model. We have to do more today. And so when you are taking Mrs. Smith a casserole who lives across the street because she's been in the hospital, say to your children, we Lutherans are not very good at this, but we need to say, I am doing something kind. I am taking Mrs. Smith a casserole because she's been in the hospital. So we underline our words, our actions with words. Okay? Yes?
I was just going to say, I don't know that I do this well all the time, but taking the teachable moments and, or instead of yelling when the virtue isn't in place,
uh-huh.
really talking about the consequence of that, or because it's usually the harder choice.
Right.
I mean, to take the virtuous path. And so what does it feel like when you don't, and why are we drawn maybe not to take
mm-hmm.
the more virtuous path, and you know, really, and taking those moments to kind of talk through it, where
mm-hmm.
instead of, for me lately, I kind of go to the consequence instead of, you know, or the punishment instead of really the letting more of the natural consequences sort of take.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple things you said that I think are important. So one is, rather than just pointing out the consequences of their behavior, that it's okay to say being mean or being hoarding of your things is not okay. To say that, you know, that's not okay with me, and here's why. One of the things I talked about in the teen class was to do those kinds of things in sound bites, and I think it's really important to do that. And not to expect the child to say, okay, I get it, no, I just hope it's fine. No, thanks for explaining that so well. But in time they get it. So it's not only reinforcing those virtues, but it's also when they exhibit you let them know that that's not okay and why, and have the courage as parents to do that. Yeah.
I think too, pointing out situations where other people are showing the values or the virtues that mm-hmm. you want. So,
yeah.
you know, someone's helping somebody because their car won't start, and
yeah.
try and say, isn't that kind?
Right, absolutely. So if you see it in, I mean, the example is, you know, Billy from next door found a $10 bill on our driveway and he brought it to the house. That shows a lot of integrity. Okay? And we don't have, you really don't have to say, and I hope you do that, and that's what I would expect you to do. You don't even have to do that. Remember, you are very powerful people in the lives of your children, and by saying that, your children get it, and that's probably all you need to say. Also, by telling stories, whether you know, it's something in your past where somebody showed integrity or honesty and it was difficult, you know, that's really important. Or if there's something in the newspaper, I can't remember exactly now, but a few years ago, and they don't do enough in the newspaper, but I can't remember what, there was a Boy Scout who did something very virtuous, and I wish I could remember what it was, but it was in the newspaper. So if we can take those opportunities to read those stories to our children, because while they love us and it's important to hear from us, it's important to know those are values out in the community that are important too, and that we as Americans or Lutherans or Christians hold dear, and other religions too. Let's see. Another one is your kids are home, they're all getting along, they're playing really nicely, and grandma calls. And you can say, boy, I wish you were here, grandma. You know, all the kids, they're all playing with Legos, and Billy's doing an airplane, and so-and-so's making a house. And so you reinforce them right there by talking to a third person on the phone. You have to be a little bit careful with siblings, though, because what will happen if you call too much attention to that moment where everybody's getting along with Legos? Pretty soon they'll stop and start fighting and grabbing. So you might want to say it as you tuck them in bed that night. But if somebody's done something really good, you know, Mary's here, she's doing her homework, I really appreciate that. And they overhear that as you talk to grandma on the phone. It's very effective. Okay, another one is for the situations that have to do with negative or the vices that children might exhibit, you can do a little bit of gossiping. Okay, here's how it goes. Did you know this? That your cousin, Corey, skipped school. She did, and she got caught. And here's what happens. For all the things that she has to have an in-school detention, and she'll get Fs for everything that occurs in school that day. And so a little bit of gossip is okay, because then children get the idea of what might occur if they were to do that. Okay, so that's any other thoughts about instilling virtues? Yes?
Well, as a Sunday school teacher, I think we're missing something important here. I teach Sunday school, and you know, a lot of the stories that we tell, you know, connect directly to
sure.
their behavior and developing their values and what's good and how to act and get along.
Absolutely. Any kind of, yeah, of course, Bible stories, we're here at, you know, Holden, we need to reinforce that. There's a lot of really good children's literature out there that drive home those virtues and values that you hold dear. So, again, more than anything, it just takes some intention on the parent, on the teacher, to do that, and that's what we're here for. Okay. Now, let's move in and talk about morals. Doing what's right when nobody's watching, doing what's right when the only person you hurt is yourself, and doing what's right when everyone else is doing what's wrong. So, again, what, you know, we all live by different moral standards, but can we all agree that we don't want our children to lie, steal, or cheat? Okay, those are things we probably want to work on. Okay, and so we can think about those as we go through this. There's many, many ways to teach your children right from wrong by your standards. So anybody have any thoughts about that, about how you go about teaching moral behavior to your children?
You admit when you do it wrong yourself, and you just
said
it.
Yeah.
I just told her a story, and I won't tell you the whole story, but
you can.
Essentially, no, it's not.
where I essentially lied to my husband in front of my daughter, and then immediately was like, I went back and she was with her boyfriend, and I said, you know, this is totally wrong, what I just did and what I said, and this is what I'm going to do about it, and this is how I'm going to handle it.
Yeah.
Because I did it, and it was a fun love. I was trying to kind of, like, be a pal with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I stepped back and went, oh, this isn't that good.
Because you're the mom, right?
Yeah. And I, you know, I don't need to be their pal. So,
yeah.
So I went and I did that, and then the first thing I said to my husband when he walked in the door is I explained what I had done, and I was really sorry. And,
yeah. So you modeled a really good thing.
Right.
And we all do things, you know, and it's hard because we'll do little white lies, or we'll cheat a little bit on our income tax, or we'll come home and realize that we underpaid for an item at the grocery store, and we kind of let it go. And you know, we've all done those kinds of things. But when you have the opportunity to make it right, and your children see you do that, you're probably driving home a very good point. Okay? Other ways to teach children moral behavior.
I think how you treat them, they will. Like, if you treat them with patience and respect, they'll probably have those. If you're impatient with your child, they're not going to have a very high tolerance
for
other people. They'll just think that's how people are.
Right.
And how you talk to them, especially. I used to work in a preschool, and you would, like, the language that was used at home was, like, was how they treated other people.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see the kids who you know, who their parents maybe didn't have that great of a relationship, or, like, didn't use very nice words. They would use those with other people.
So it's a really good point, because we as adults can be very kind and compassionate to other people outside the home. But if, and even to our spouse, but sometimes, not always, we think to little children, we can change our behavior. And certainly, because we have a responsibility, I mean, you know, there's times when we have to be clearer, because it's a very intimate relationship between you and your child, so we have a little bit more freedom to tell them exactly what's on our mind, where we wouldn't do that with a stranger. But we can always do it with kindness and respect and compassion, and it's hard, particularly if you weren't raised in a home like that. Then you have to switch that around. So, okay, how else are you going to teach moral behavior to your children? Okay.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Some children who are very, very sensitive to the right and wrong ways of doing things, for whatever reason, become very rigid.
Right.
And can become very judgmental.
Right.
Because this is wrong and this is right.
Uh-huh.
So you're trying to establish some guidelines for them without moving into that realm. How do you bridge that?
That's a really interesting question, because what we have to understand, of course, when children are little, that they're much more black and white in the moral realm. And then when they get to be between 6 and 12, there's a little bit more, well, actually, between 6 and 12, they're more habitual, I should say, between in the preschool years. And they're still acquiring self-control. So even though we're saying it's not okay to hit because we love our brother and whatnot, they don't have the self-control not to do that. But between 6 and 12, they're very rule-oriented, and they get to be more black and white. And then as they get to be teenagers, they see more gray in moral issues. And so here's just an example with that. So I have three granddaughters, and my oldest one is 5, and her sister will be 3 in September. And then, so that's from my daughter's family. And then my son has one little girl who is almost a year old. And so the oldest, Amelia, was saying about Violet, the youngest, when is Violet going to get baptized? And I said, well, you know, Amelia, I really don't know. And Amelia was, because I take Amelia to church, and her sister was recently baptized. And Amelia said, well, she has to get baptized. All children have to get baptized. I mean, it just, you know, and she calls it baptizing, which I think is very interesting too. But anyway, and so therefore you have to say, and so what I said to her, I mean, of course I feel that way, but yet I have to be respectful of my son's family. And so I said to Amelia, who's very rigid, black and white, you know, at 5 years old, and I said, well, you know, that's really, that decision is really up to Jerry and Chris, and Uncle Jerry and Aunt Christy. And so, you know, I helped her see that it, while yes, we really want her to be baptized, that decision is up. So we let her see a little bit of gray. And I think you can do that with kids. Give them that, they're not going to get it right away. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, in the back? Yes.
I think sometimes with morals, I start thinking in terms of personal behavior, and particularly with adolescents, the issues of decision making and how a quick 30-second decision can have such long range.
Right, yeah.
And in some of these small sound bites, sometimes I think about the phrase living with care and caution. You know, whatever way you can share that message, knowing that those decisions, and particularly adolescents, you get into things like drinking and driving, substance abuse,
right,
various things like that, but getting out of this care and caution. But you can't always hammer away the idea of the consequences. It's important to remind them that those kind of things can happen.
Right, right. And just one of the things I want to emphasize, and I talked about it with the teens, and I'm not sure how old all of your children are, but please understand that any of these things are most effectively taught between the ages of 6 and 12, when your children still like you, and when they're not questioning and rejecting and rebelling against your values. And so, you know, that's why it's real. I mean, how many of you want your children to drink alcohol and use drugs in high school? I don't see one hand. And so you need to start talking about that issue around the kitchen table when your children are between 6 and 12. And to say things like, you know, there might be times when you're at a party and people will offer you some alcohol or marijuana. And how can you keep that friend but reject the substance that they're offering you? And so you can have those conversations starting at a young age. And why do we hate to do that? Why do we hate to do that? Because it's, in my mind, it's because we feel like we're taking a little bit away from their childhood innocence. And I hate to do that too. But you can start, maybe you wouldn't do it at 6, but certainly by 8, 9, and 10, they know it. They are smarter than you about it. And so you might as well open up the conversation and become educated yourself about it, as hard as it is. I mean, so, we want to start at a young age. So anyway, that being said, let me get into this information a little bit more, that to be aware of the developmental process again, that lying, stealing, and cheating, of course, we do not want preschool-age children to do that, but they have a very different concept of what that is than the child 6 to 12, and I'll give you some examples. When my daughter was 3 and a half, she loved to play Candyland. Are you all familiar with the game Candyland?
Oh, yes.
And so she was real busy in the living room one day, and you know, she wasn't right by my side. She was in there busy setting up the Candyland board, and pretty soon she comes in and she says, "Do you want to play Candyland?" So I said, "Oh, sure, Al." Like, you know. So she says, "You go first." And so I knew something was up, right? And so, you know, I picked blue. Uh-huh. And then she picked lollipops. Oh, my lollipops. So then I picked red, and then she picked gingerbread. So she had stacked the deck, right? And so you don't want to say to a three-year-old, "You cheater, you know, you're never going to have any friends," this, that, and the other thing I just said to her. Because she wasn't thinking in terms of cheating. She had just figured out how to win the game, right? And so anyway, so you have to be a little bit different, what I'm saying, with preschool-age children than school-age. Another one is, this happened to a friend of mine, that she was home with her daughter, and her daughter had this imaginary friend, and the imaginary friend's name was Tuji. And so, you know, unfortunately, one day my friend noticed that one of her precious vases was broken. And so she said, and the mom knew she hadn't done it, and there's only two people in the house. There was mom and Sarah. And so the mom said, Sarah, I see that this vase is broken. Oh yeah, Tuji did it. Okay, Tuji being the imaginary friend. And so then, of course, it's, you know, if you read about imaginary friends, it's really okay to go with them to have them in your house and support your child's imaginary friend. It's a very healthy mental thing for them to do. But when they use them to, you know, be blamed for the act, then you say, "No, we know that Tuji is imaginary and she really didn't do it, and so now we need to clean it up or repair it or whatever." But that's a normal thing. I mean, I wouldn't harshly reprimand or punish a child for doing that. It's a developmental thing. And so then another example was, when my son was 2.5, my husband took him to the grocery store, and he came home and he said, "I will never, never, never take that child to a grocery store again." I said, "Well, what happened?" I said, "Well," he said, "well, he climbed out of the grocery cart and was walking in the frozen food section." Where was he watching the child? He broke a dozen eggs and he stole a pack of gum. And I said, "Well, did you take him back into the grocery store to," this is the same appliance kid, right? He humbled me, still does. But anyway, and so I said, "Well, did you take him back into the store and return the gum?" He said, "No." He said, "It's the store's fault. They had them available right there." He was already in his car seat. I was not going to take him back into the store. But anyway, the point I'm making is, you know, 2.5 is totally different than 10, age 10. And so while he probably should have taken the gum back in and paid for it, it's a different thing. So we want to be careful that we're age appropriate. That's what I'm saying when it comes to instilling virtues, values, and morals in children, particularly this moral thing. So to get into a little deeper, to give you some ideas further about what to do to instill morals in your children, I'm going to run through 5 moral emotions, okay? And these 5 emotions will help you on the road to instilling your morals in your children. The first moral emotion is pride, okay? So let your children know what brings you pride. Because mostly, when your children are doing things that are morally right by you, they will see pride written all over your face. Now, pride has gotten some bad press lately because children can get hooked on pride. And as I said yesterday, the worst thing that you do is to say to your child, "I'm so proud of you, I don't care." But there's some educators that don't like that. Just to understand that there's many ways to communicate pride to your children. One is by saying, "You know how to write your name? Let me watch you." So just watching them do something is you're that powerful a person that if they're doing something that's right by your standard, then just to watch them do it is enough of a reinforcement. You don't have to say, "I'm so proud of you," okay? Just by watching. Okay, another one is to show interest. So if your children are cooperating and they're being generous with one another and they're playing with Legos and building, if you enter too and start building and getting involved, you're reinforcing that behavior without saying anything, okay? Another one is by describing it. As I said, you know, about the cookie, "I saw you break your cookie in half and give half to your brother. That's being very kind." Or, "I see that you're putting a Band-Aid on your brother's knee. Never mind that you just pushed him down on the sidewalk and that's why he has a scraped knee." But anyway, that's showing a lot of compassion. So you describe what they're doing. Also, by having adoring looks. I mean, if your child is practicing the piano, if you just look adoringly at her while she's doing that, or if they're reading and you show interest in what they're reading, that's another way of reinforcing that good behavior.
Uh-huh. How important is it to talk to them about how that makes them feel? So that they're not only doing something
right.
to make
okay.
you proud, but
good point.
For their...
Yeah, I mean, what are there's several, you can say, how does that make you feel when you've just played that piece for grandma? How do you feel? Another thing that I say is, "I'm proud to be your grandma." So that they feel that rather than saying, "I'm so proud of you," it gives them more power to say, "I'm proud to be your to be your grandmother or your mother because of what you did." So anyway, when children do something that's right, to let them know that by communicating your pride in a variety of different ways, because that means that they're doing right by your standard. Okay, how will they know if you don't communicate that to them? So you need to do that. Okay, all right, Jan, check that one off. We'll do that. Okay, the next one is empathy. All right, so we want to teach children, and empathy actually starts at about 18 months. that children can begin to step into the minds and emotions of somebody else to see how they feel. Think about the world if we couldn't feel empathy. If I needed a piece of paper, I would just go yank it out of one of your hands without thinking, well, that's your tablet and you're using it, and that would be a very rude thing to do. But since I know that that would be a rude thing to do, I can step in, you know, because I can step into your mind and emotions, I can figure out how to get a piece of paper in another way, right? But we're empathetic people, and we want to help our children figure out how their behavior affects other people. So, if you hit your sister and she's crying, I'm not going to say to the crying child, buck up, be tough, hitting doesn't hurt. No, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to say to this girl, the hitter, I'm going to say, look at your sister. She's crying. Hitting hurts. So it helps you to step into her mind and emotions to see how your behavior has affected her. Or if your child comes home and says, yeah, you know, there's 8 girls in my class and I'm inviting all of them to my birthday party except Jennifer. Okay, I don't like Jennifer. We're not going to have her. So, and this is a moral issue for a parent, but I mean, at least you can say, you know, do you invite Jennifer or not? I don't know. But you can say, let's think about how Jennifer's going to feel to be the only girl in the class left out. So you can pose those moral issues to your children that can develop their empathy. The truth about empathy, too, is that some children get it right away, and other children have a very hard time doing that. And bullies who are established at about age 8 really don't get it. And that's a whole other topic, but that's why we want to teach empathetic behavior most effectively between 18 months and 8 years. But it can continue for a long, long time, but those are kind of the key years. Okay, so the next one is, the next moral emotions to use with your children are embarrassment and disappointment, okay? So now, you know, as parents we have to be very ethical, but these can be very effective. All right, so let's say you're at a restaurant with your 2-year-old, and your 2-year-old begins to misbehave, and you know, it's ridiculous to say I'm embarrassed. 2-year-olds don't dine, right? And so, you know, so basically you just pick the child up, clean them off, you know, take them out until they calm down, either go home or return to your meal once they calm down. But if you're there with an 8-year-old and your 8-year-old is misbehaving at a restaurant, you can say, I'm embarrassed. I expect better behavior from you at a restaurant. Or you can say, I'm disappointed. Okay, and that's all you have to say. Because what children do then is they recognize that their behavior is not only embarrassing to mom and dad, but that eventually they're embarrassing themselves. Now, am I the only person who've changed and improved my behavior because I've embarrassed myself? We have all done that, right? We've all done embarrassing things, and then we kind of think later, ooh, I shouldn't do this, I'm not going to do it again. Yes?
What's the bottom age for that?
Well, it's, I think that's a, you know, it's a hard question. Somewhere between 3 and 5, okay? That children, actually it's called emotional eavesdropping, and children pick up on your emotions really pretty young, but I would be safe to use it between 3 and 5. And you don't want to overdo it. I think you have to be really cautious about that. But, I mean, if you're with your 2.5-year-old and you're at a shopping mall and you're in the process of potty training and your child has an accident at the shopping mall, you don't say, I'm so embarrassed, or I bet you're embarrassed too. You just clean the child up and go home or whatever, right? But if you're there with your 5-year-old and they have an accident, and you can say, you know, I bet you're feeling a little embarrassed. And that's an okay kind of feeling. And the disappointment one is that, let's say you're going on an airplane, you're taking your 5- and 7-year-old, they've never been on an airplane before, so you've coached them about how to behave, you've played about airplanes a little bit, you know, got the chairs lined up and played flight attendant or whatever, and, you know, practice with seatbelts, you kind of have an idea of, you know, how you go through security and all that. And so you say to your children, you know, on the airplane, I have 2 expectations for you. One is that you're quiet and not disturb other people. And the second is that you keep your seatbelt on unless you have to get up to go to the bathroom. So you're taking your kids on the airplane, and they're horrible. You know, they're yelling and won't get their seatbelt on. And so it's okay to say, I'm disappointed. I expected. You know, and you don't have to go on forever, but you can communicate that to your children without harming your relationship or their delicate psyche. And so, anyway, I have to tell this one story. When my son was going to be a senior in high school, his cousin, who's was in his early 30s, asked him to go camping in the Sierras. And so I said to Alan, you know, do you want to do this? He said, no. He said, I just don't want to go. He said, I really need the month before school just to hang out and do nothing. And I just don't want to do it. And so I said, I mean, I was a senior. I can't force him on the airplane, right? So I said, you know, nice kid, but, you know, he's the appliances kid.
Yeah.
all my stories come from Alan. But anyway, so I said, Alan, I cannot force you to go hiking and camping in the Sierras with Robert, your cousin. I just want you to know, if you don't do this, I'm going to be really disappointed. He went. He had a great time. Now, you can see with a teenager that if you played that disappointment card very often, it wouldn't be effective. So use it sparingly, but it can be very effective.
So how do you, I mean, and this is probably not really an answerable question. How do you go about divorcing your disappointment from, I can see how you would say that, and mm-hmm. I can see how you would think, well, my kid is going to have an okay time, but at what point do you start letting your child's values and desires take the lead?
That's when parenting is an art form. It's an art form. I mean, sometimes you get it right and sometimes you don't, and you try out different things, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But I don't think you can, you have to, I think it's important in a family if you can keep those feelings separate. I don't want to elude you to think that I can always do it, because I can't. As hard as, you just hope, John Gottman, who's the emotions guru from Washington State, from University of Washington, he says, yeah, he's not a cougar, he's a husky, let's make that clear. Anyway, he says that if you get it right in parenting, 60% of the time, you're doing a really good job. I remember him saying that, and he's a researcher, and I'm thinking, okay, I can do 60%. And so, yeah, but if you're feeling disappointed, you know, I mean, let's say your child, I remember, this is my daughter, one day, you know, high schooler, she said, I don't know why she was so mad, but she said, Dad, I have no respect for you, none. And, you know, he's a nice dad, he's good to these kids, he, you know, does all kinds of, you know, whatever, builds rapport, good disciplinary, all this. I don't know what he did that she was so mad. And so then, you know, later, about 30 minutes later, she comes down and she says, you know, Dad, Tolo's coming up. You know, Tolo's when the girls take the boys. And I'll probably need about $60 for that. Huh. I said, Emma, I can't, you just said it, I have no respect for me. I cannot give you $60, you know. And so I'm disappointed in that you said that. So I just can't hand over $60. And so she was like, ooh. You know, but you know, it's just not good parenting, right, to hand over $60. So anyway, I'm almost done. Okay, so we started about 5 minutes late, so I have 5 more minutes. Okay, so two more. So we got embarrassment and disappointment. The next one is guilt, and I love talking about this in Poland because Lutherans are pretty good at guilt. Anyway, let's say your child picks the flowers in, your six-year-old, picks the flowers in Mr. Smith's yard. He picks 6 tulips, okay, and comes in the house with them. This is the second time he's done it, all right? Now, so he knows he's not supposed to do that. And what I want to say about this is that knowing and doing are very different for children, really for all of us. Because if you said to me, Jan, is it a good idea to eat a full bag of potato chips all by yourself? I'd say, no, that's a bad idea. But sometimes I eat salty, crunchy, and I just can't help myself. Okay, so knowing and doing are two different things. Okay, so this little child knows he's not supposed to do it, but he did it anyway. Okay, so we're going to reprimand that child. We are going to say, Adam, that is not okay. Those are Mr. Smith's tulips. Those are not yours to pick. That is not okay to do it. We're going to reprimand him for 30 to 45 seconds. We want to be clear about it. We want to use the pronoun I don't like it. That's not okay. That kind of thing. All right. One time in a parenting class, I said 30 to 45 minutes. And a dad raised his hand in the back. He said, Jen, that's kind of a long time. It's seconds. Okay. I can be really clear with the reprimand for 30 to 45 seconds. Okay. Now what are you going to do? Okay, we've reprimanded the child. He's feeling a little bit guilty, right? He's feeling bad about what he did. Remember, the pastor talked about that the other night. Guilt involves what you did. Okay, so he's been reprimanded for what he did. Now what are we going to do? He's feeling a little bit guilty. What are we going to do?
Walk over to the neighbor woman.
And?
Give him a bouquet.
Give him a
bouquet of flowers.
And say, I'm sorry. Okay, so we might have the child, you know, plant some other flowers or make up for it in some way, right? He's going to make up for it in some way. And we're probably going to have to call the neighbor and say, my son's coming over to apologize, because quite often the neighbor would say, oh, that's okay. Don't worry about it. We want him to, you know, this is a serious offense, okay? So the child says, we're going to apologize. So, Adam, you need to apologize to Mr. Smith. Now what are you going to do? You're going to apologize for the child. You're going to say, Mr. Smith, I'm really sorry that my child, Adam, picked your flowers, okay? And he's going to take his allowance and buy you some new tulip bulbs or whatever it is. Okay, so you're modeling that behavior for your child, and in time they will catch on. And now, yes?
And then when you go home, do you say, I'm really disappointed in you that you didn't
you
apologize?
Can say, well, you can, sure, or practice, or, yeah, I mean, it takes, it's a very mature, oh, I missed the
30 or 40 minutes.
Yeah, right. So, yeah, you can say that, I mean, but the point of it is he'll get it in time. We have to remember these are children. He's a six-year-old. So certainly we want to take action, but we don't want to overdo it. And also, now we're done, right? We reprimanded him. He apologized. He made up for it. And now we're done. We're not going to keep bringing it up. Remember, 3 days ago, 3 weeks ago, 3 months ago, 3 years ago, remember the day that you picked the flowers and Mr. No, we're not going to do that, okay? We are not going to do that. All right,
Jen,
we're done with it.
Jen, on that, isn't that exactly what Dr. Freckheim said about shame?
Yes.
That by doing it chronically, by doing it 30 to 45 minutes,
right,
that turns it into toxic shame.
Exactly.
And really hurts the child.
Right, and that you were listening, and
yeah,
so was I, and that leads to the fifth moral emotion, which is shame, which we do not want children to experience, okay? Shame means I'm bad for who I am, mm-hmm, all right? And that either paralyzes children, I can't do anything because I feel so bad about who I am, or they become amoral, and it's like, well, I am bad, so I'm just going to keep doing that. What difference does it make? So those five, really four, moral emotions can serve you very well in instilling your morals in your children. And lastly, I just want to say to be low-key and intentional about instilling virtues, values, and morals. So you don't want to shove it down their throat, you know what I mean? But you want to be you want to be low-key and intentional, insistent, unwavering, but subtle. You don't want to be values neutral. You want to mind your children's business. And, I mean, you don't want to snoop and sneak, but you want to stay on top of what's happening so that you can seize these opportunities. So, okay, I think I'm done. And there's a handout here. This is just my general handout. And if you want to email me for a full handout on instilling virtues, values, and morals in children, I'd be happy to do that once I get back to Seattle. So thank you all very much.